Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you, Paula. My name is Marianne, and I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is November 11th, 1989. I have a sponsor. Her name is Polly P. And she's got a beautiful sponsor named Rena. And their love and support this weekend has just been absolutely amazing. Absolutely incredible. Rena, my talk with you last night, I just felt like a grandmother's hands, you know, and I never had a grandma. Well, I had grandmas, but I never knew either one of them. And so I don't know what that is. I'm being a grandma. I've got 8 grandchildren, and so I get to do that. I'm Disney grandma, I call myself. my heart is so full. So full to be at this beautiful place this weekend, and breathe. I have a beautiful roommate, April, that has just kept our room with, you know, we've been in prayer and we've been in contemplation, and I just thank you for that so much. And Paula has been the best hostess ever. Beth. And she said, you know, that Melina was going to be here and Melina was going to host me, and she's a longtime friend from Bellingham, Washington. Yeah. But what I do know about God is this, and it just really reminded me of that when you just said that. You know, I might not be the first choice or the second choice, but I'm the right choice. And you're the right choice, so thank you so much. The right choice. And so I have a home group. It's Alcoholics and God, and we meet in Fort Lauderdale on Monday nights. We go through the Krusty Cliff style line-on-line big book on Monday nights, and on Thursday night we have a speaker series meeting. And if you ever, you know, are in the area and you want to stop by, please do. And Girl Stock is so special to my heart, and I just want to share an experience of the first year I got here. And, you know, I'm still in a lot of double-digit untreated alcoholism, and I moved and packed my bags from Bellingham, Washington, to Florida. And it was a huge transition in my life, and it was a huge time of seeking God and a huge time of blowing up Polly's phone, like, how do I do this? How do I leave everything I've ever known? And I just kind of moved down there, and I came into the doors here of Girl Stock, and I had my own room, and I was alone, and the place, you know, Sonia, thank you so much for saying that self-pity thing wherever you are. I mean, thank you for opening your heart and getting up early and sharing that song this morning. It means the world to me. Is she just amazing? Just amazing. And as a singer myself, I believe that, you know, the power of music, and it just opens our hearts to what God has to give us. And so I came into my first conference here. And see, where I go back to, like so many of us alcoholics, is I don't belong, I'm not enough, nobody wants me around, all that stuff. And those voices in our head can get so, so, so loud. And I isolated in my room, and I sat in the back row, and I didn't jump in and get around the women, and I kept it all, like, inside of me, and I was miserable, like, miserable the first few hours. And one of our dear friends, Jeannie H., was sitting back there, and I opened my mouth, and she said, get here, you sit with me. And I'm telling you, the weekend was so powerful and so beautiful that I've brought women back here with me, you know, I've brought a crew of women with me, and it's just something so special, and there's just something about God's grace. So you people in the back row, I know who you are. I'm a back row girl, and I feel like I'm, you know, my whole life has been this story of I don't fit. I don't belong. I'm the dirty little girl who lives on Lincoln Street and, you know, and nobody goes to my house. And there's so much shame and there's so much, it's just, you know, filth and deprivation and anger and alcoholism. And my mom would cook one meal a day because my father was a construction worker, and she'd have a meal, a drunk meal, ready for her at the end of the day. And so we fended for ourselves. We had six kids. We were the dysfunctional Brady Bunch, man. We were like, I was in the middle girl. I was a middle girl, and I was Jan, and I wanted to be Marsha, you know? And I, you know, so many times it's like those are the things that are like, it was the theme to my life, is I just be somebody else? Can I just be somebody else? And I can tell you today, through the power of the 12 steps and great sponsorship and a beautiful, beautiful fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I love my mother, and I'm named after her, and I'm Marion the Turd, they called me, because I had an Aunt Marion, and my mom's name was Marion, and I was the third, you know, and that used to bring me a lot of, you know, we'd answer the phone, and it'd be like, is Marion there? Big or little, big or little, big or little, and I couldn't stand that, but today, you know, I'm so proud of where I come from, and I'm so proud of my mother and father and how hard they work to make our life okay, but it was ugly, you know, a lot of times, and in this family, you know, like, we use the word dysfunctional family so much, and my family, we came together, man. I don't know if you were raised with brothers and sisters and that crazy alcoholism, but we made stuff work. And one thing underneath all of that stuff was I know my mother loved me, and I know my father loved me, and I'm so grateful for all those things. Like, you know, there's women in this room today that, you know, Beth and Georgia, you know, I sat in the back row of all alone, and the first conferences I came to here, and I wasn't enough, and I could hear you up here, and it's like, look at them, they're shining stars, you know, and then there's me, you know, and God's just like, I can tell you that at 28 years of sobriety, and where I stand here today, I have a life like my lovely, beautiful, like when Polly came into my life in 2004, so did Dave. So did Dave, and he coached me through coming out of an abusive marriage. I mean, that man was, I think he loves us to life, us broken women, and please give him my love today. I call him, a lot of women call him dad, and I call him, he's my big bro, you know, always encouraging me. And gift after gift that God's giving me, whether, you know, when I left that husband on a last day, on a last breath, on a last moment, I mean, when Mildred was talking about that last night, I went home for one last fight. I knew it was going to be one last fight. I don't know how I knew this, but that intuitive voice or whatever. And I went to my little AA meeting, and I talked to my friend Hugh, and I said, I'm going home for one last fight. My kids were raised, and they were out of the house, and I was stood in my driveway on top of Squalicum Mountain in Bellingham, Washington, and I looked up at the sky, and I was like, this was a man with untreated alcoholism, and he was broken, and he was sick, and it wasn't good. But I stood there, and I was coming up on my 25th wedding anniversary. I was coming up on being 45 years old, and I was coming up on being 15 years sober. And I stood there, and this isn't like you know, this is a women's conference, so I'm a little more open. And like Polly says, people share a girl's stock a little different than they do at a normal place. And I stood there, and I went home. I told Hugh, I said, my buddy, he was part of the Northwest, Great Northwest group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I told him I'm going to go home, have one more fight. And I went upstairs to my living room, and, you know, the cycle of domestic violence is scary, you know. It's like you're speaking one language, they're speaking in another language. You don't even know what you're fighting about. I don't know whether to be nice. I don't know whether to be mean. I don't know. And we fought. I came downstairs, and I said, I'm leaving. And I went downstairs. He tried to pull the keys out of my hand. And by God's grace, I was afraid, and I'm on top of a mountain, and I'm, you know, there's nobody around. And for the first time in my life with him, I just started screaming at him at the top of my lungs. Give me my keys. I got to get the F out of here. I got to get out of here. I'm so mad. And he gave the keys to me. And I drove off in my little Jeep off that mountain. And what happened, see, so to give you some backdrop to that, what had happened is I got, you know, I started leading worship in this Pentecostal church. And I was going to that preacher and I was saying all this stuff about my husband, just pray for him, just pray for him, just pray for him, just pray for him. And that day when I left, see, what I was busy doing was it all looked really fancy from the altar. You know, we'd have fights on the way to church, and I'd get there and look all shiny and go up in front and sing in front of everybody like everything's okay, and I was dying inside. And what I'd do is I'd go into the rooms of our beautiful, amazing, incredible Mother Church of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was full of spiritual pride. I was so seething of spiritual pride walking in. And, you know, our book talks about our spiritual walk to be in addition to, never instead of. And it flipped, man. It had flipped. And I'd walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd be like, yeah, if they just get Jesus like I got him, you know. If they just be like me, you know. I get around Marianne because she's so spiritual. Dying of the bedevilments, dying of untreated alcoholism. And so what I did is I picked up the phone on my drive out, and I'm praying, God, please don't let him follow me. Please don't let him follow me. I drive out to Northern Belmont. All I knew was to just drive north. And I called my friend Marlena. Oh, yeah, you made it. I called my friend Marlena. She was having an AA tea party on a Sunday. Well, you know, there was no tea involved. It was coffee. It was cigarettes. It was talking crap. And it's what a say. I mean, it was just awesome. And it was my girls. It was my girls. And I called her and I said, and because see, the AA people knew. It wasn't like I kept it a total secret from them. They knew what was going on. It's like, when are you going to go? When are you going to leave? When is this going to happen? And I called her and I said, I'm coming to the party. She's going, you're coming? I said, yeah, I left. She goes, oh, you get to make it to the tea party. I said, no, I left. I left. I'm gone. Because what had happened is that was my 25th wedding anniversary. A couple days before, there's this song that Martina McBride does called God, When God-Fearing Women Get the Blues. This woman actually leaves after her 25th wedding anniversary. It's like, to the nail, my life. It's so weird. And to the nail, I don't know whatever that means. And so, and she goes, you left? You, and what happened was I had my Jeep, I had a suitcase overpacked with clothes, and I had a guitar in the back of my car, and I'm like, I got everything I need. I'm loaded, man. I got it all. And she yells, all these women are there from my beautiful Northwest crazy group. And she yells, she left. She left. She finally left, the son of a... You know what? And these women were so beautiful. They took me in and we cleaned out checking accounts that night and they put me in, you know, Eleanor's like, we got to get to the ATMs. I know you can make a withdrawal here, withdrawal here, withdrawal here, you know, and it was awesome. And Marlena put me up in her house and we got to a restraining order. We got to a lawyer, you know, they walked me through. See, guess what, guys, when the church turned their back on me, and I am not knocking church. They know their job is to help heal marriages. They don't know how to do divorce. They didn't know how to, and God bless it all. God bless it all. But it wasn't up to the church to save my butt. It was up to me to lean on you. It was up to me to reach out to my beautiful, amazing, incredible AA women. And those women took me in and they saved my life. And over again, the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. And if you're new here, and I'm talking save my life, that kind of action, but I'm talking save my life when I'm out having a smoke in the parking lot, and I mean, even this was like Friday night, and my head's going, oh God, I'm speaking, there's all those fancy women, they're so awesome, and I got to get up there, what am I going to say that's going to make any difference, and I don't even remember which woman I was talking to, but just to get the heck out of my head, just the heck to be of service to somebody else, because guess what, that's the only place where freedom comes for me. The only place when my thought, when this was read, constant thought, you know, thoughts of others. Holy smoke. If I'm either, you know, and somebody said it too, I might not be much, but I'm all that I ever think about. And whether I'm like, wow, I made it to the big leagues and I'm up here where Beth was, you know, I'm like, yeah. Or whether, or, you know, I'm less than Georgia, or I can't sing like Sonia, or whatever that comparison. Anytime I compare myself to somebody else, I'm in trouble. Always, always in trouble. I'm better than, I'm less than. So the beautiful Room of Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me to stay right size. Like I always, you know, I have this wonderful fiance. He's kind of radical in AA, very radical in AA. I mean, he's like very radical. And when I first started getting to South Florida and I got to do talks and do this stuff, it would be like, I would try to turn into super spiritual, super Marian, you know, like, oh my God, now I've got to shine because I'm with Peter M., you know. And what I've learned, and Polly has helped walk me through this so much of just being you. And if I can tell you anything that is my heart cry with women, with people, it's like, if I'm messing around with what this package is, with what, you know, I wanted to come here, I wanted to be off my organic light cigarettes before I got here, because that would look so much cooler if I'm still not smoking. I wanted to be 10 pounds lighter, you know, I totally overshot for this trip, spent way too much money, you know, it's like, because of the things you can control, what is the outside going to look, what's it going to feel like, you know, what's it going to feel like getting up there and wanting to do honor to Polly. That's why when she prayed with me this morning and said, God, please just help her not suck. That's her short prayer. I love it. I absolutely love it. So as I've walked through recovery and as I've walked through these 12 steps, and, you know, I got to go back a little about what got me into the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had three little children, and I'm married to the guy I met at a party who was just like my dad. He was hot. It's the 70s, and he has these stretchy cords on and no shirt, and he's drunk, and he's in a fight at a party, and it was instant love at first sight. I looked across the room, and there's my man, you know. There's my man. And I stayed married to him for a very long time. But got pregnant. My dad was in Alaska because he would work in summers through the fall and winter as a laborer, and then he'd go fishing in Alaska. My mom was born and raised up there, so I've got alley-oop Alaskan Indian in me. And so here I am with the guy. my dad's gone. I get married. I'm 5 months pregnant. My dad's in Alaska. He can't stand the guy. He was right all the time. But you know what? I through the power of prayer and all that, you know, I have been put in a place of neutrality, safe and protected with him. I wish him the best. If he was Trump's right-hand man, I don't care. You know, God bless him. He's moved on with his life. He has children. It is what it is. It's beautiful. But at this time, I had three little kids. They were 4, 5, and 6 years old. I'm the drunk housewife. Other things were happening in my life that went along with that aren't AA. But I'm trying to give my little kids, see, we bought my mom and dad's house, and we built him a tree house, and we gave him a sandbox, and I was busy washing their face and giving them clean clothes, and I was trying to give them everything that I could. And you know, our friend Donna Halverson says this, and I, one of those things, those nuggets I just absolutely love so much. She says, I love and I cherish and I abused and I neglected my children. And man, that set me free. Years ago at Mount Baker Roundup, I heard her say that for the first time. I was like, man, that was me. I didn't, because I was so locked in, I loved and I cherished them. I couldn't look at the fact that I abused and I neglected them. And so 1986, I get, I'm going to screw with my hair a lot. I get pregnant with my fourth child, and we were really kind of excited about it. My daughter was 4, her name's Jessica, and she's 36. And Jake is 37 now, but he was 5, and Brandon, who's 38. So we were kind of excited, and they were stair steps, and they were quick, and there's alcoholism, but there's this love and cherish and abuse and neglect, all of it, right? And so I get pregnant with my fourth child, and I'm thinking, okay, well, this one we can all kind of raise together. We're going to diaper them. We're going to, you know, it's kind of cool, you know? So super excited about that. I'm in full-blown alcoholism. I don't know it's alcoholism. I think I'm doing okay because of the trampoline and the sandbox and the treehouse, you know, and the clean socks. And so Brian was born October 19th, 1987. And on January 22nd, October 19th, 1986, January 22nd, 1987, I had gone back to work at Safeway, and my little sister was babysitting him, and he was laying in her bed. And I got home from work, and I went into her bedroom. She went into the bedroom to pick him up so I could leave, and he was purple. And And my sister and I'm 27 years old. I don't know what death looks like. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know what's wrong with him. And I'm driving to the hospital, and I'm saying, just give him mouth to mouth, give him mouth to mouth, give him mouth to mouth. And we got to the hospital. I brought him up to the nurse, and I fell on the floor. And the nurse, I swear it was Nurse Ratchet, God bless her, but she just walked out, and she said, your baby's dead. And what had happened was he had died a crib death in my sister's house that day. And talk about what a long, long, long trip it was. I couldn't see a baby carriage. I couldn't see a baby. I couldn't take care of my children. My world was wrecked. And that same year, later on that year, in August of that year, my mom died of lung cancer and emphysema. And so, like, I could not get enough booze in my body. I couldn't get enough booze in my body to kill the pain. And I had gone to see a shrink. She said, I'm crazy. But what she said to me was, you know, Marion, you're having trouble living. You know, when you lose a child, you lose your future. And when you lose a parent, you lose your past. And you're having trouble living in today. So fast forward a year later, my kids find God at a little Baptist church from a Sunday school bus. And I find a God of my understanding, and I'm going home. I don't know who was saying this about reading the Bible. I'm reading the Bible, and I'm highlighting, and I've got a box of almond and wine and everything to go along with it, and I'm like, yay, God, you know. But I can't get sober, and I'm waking up with the hideous four horsemen every morning, you know, and I'd run to that preacher. It's like, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? So on the morning of November 11th, 1989, I go down to my little pink bathroom, and I look in the mirror, and I see the place we call the gift of desperation, and God gave me the gift of desperation that day, and went to one treatment center, and then I ended up here. Boy, how did I get down that rabbit trail? It was a big rabbit trail, but I needed just to let you know how I got here, okay? And so, first quick sponsor who, she died of grace and dignity in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her name was Kathy Downs, and she was a rock star in Bellingham AA. You know, she really, really was. And she'd call me and she'd gripe at me, Marion, we got step work to do. We got step work to do. And I'd be like, Kathy, I don't want to bug you. And she's like, no, you're going to deny me of my sobriety by not calling me. You're going to deny me of that. And through the steps and through this program and her just getting my hand in the hand of God, which I absolutely agree with, 100%, and being able to do my first thorough fifth step with a pastor. See, she was sick and she was dying, and I got my first fifth step. I went to a meeting, and I came so close to drinking, and I know that day I was at this wedding, and there was a drink in my hand, and I don't know how it got there. The strange mental blank spot, but it was right here, you know. And I was able to put that down that day, and God came between me and that drink that day. God came between me and that drink. And I moved forward in the steps. You know when they say if you don't do a fifth, you're going to drink a fifth? That's where I was. And so I did, and I moved forward, and I moved forward through that inventory. And I moved forward to cleaning up my past. And I can tell you today that I had that. You know, Joe and Charlie talk about this. They say, you know, some of us have our spiritual awakening at step one. Sometimes we have it at two. Sometimes we have it at three. Sometimes we have it at four. You know, we don't know where that's going to happen at. We really, really don't, you know. And Charlie says, you know, I just woke up one day and I didn't want a drink. And I hadn't thought about a drink. And he was trying to figure out where it happened at, and he couldn't say. But my step five was profound for me. It was profound, and what I felt like was there was a separation between the woman who I was and the woman who I was to be. And I can tell you, I fell in love with the idea of cleaning out all that crap. When I sat with that pastor, because Kathy was sick, I'm sitting with a man that... helped me bury my son. I'm sitting with a man that helped me and held my hand when my mom was dying. And he would go to the treatment centers. Randy Bachman had a treatment center, remember? In Linden, Washington. That's BTO, you guys, if you don't know. Anyway, so he would listen to all these fifth steps. And he was my hero, man. He was a man who loved God. He loved God. I didn't even know God, but I knew that that man loved God, and he never pushed it on me. He just loved me. He was this big 70s preacher with a pastel blue suit and a big afro, and he was just so loved. He was just an amazing man. And I tried to get out of that fifth step with him. I tried to get out. I'd call it, you know, back in the day, we didn't have cell phones. We'd have these little matchbooks and napkins with phone numbers, and they're all sitting on the dresser. And 9 o'clock that morning, I'm going through all of them, and it's like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? I can't do it with him. But what this has to do with is setting place for this stuff in 10 and 11. I'm really going to get there, I promise you. But I poured out those pages, and I cried, and it was so humbling, and it was so excruciatingly painful to sit with one of my heroes. And when I got done, I looked up from the pages, and he looked at me, and he said, were you afraid I wasn't going to love you anymore? He's like, God loves you. Like Jennifer says, there's nothing you can do to make God love you more, and there's nothing you can do to make him love you less. And I was a free woman. And I can tell you, as I've moved through the steps and those character defects, and time again through the steps with Polly, or with, you know, I'm currently in it. I just did an 8-hour fifth step with someone that was just crazy, and a list of character defects. I was like, going, holy cow, I'm screwed up, you know? And But that's it, the continuous work. The continuous work. Because for me, I gotta stay clean. I gotta be free of these things that block me from the sunlight of the Spirit. You know, whether I'm 28 years sober or 30, you know what? I'm passionate about women with long-term sobriety that just share from the podium how dang screwed up they are. And I love that. It's so beautiful and it's so precious and it's so real and it's so current. Where am I currently? Where am I now? Not hanging my hat on, I got 28 years, aren't I something? You know, because in a flash of a moment, I go back to little Marion, 6 years old, the teacher washing my face and combing my hair and telling me it's going to be okay. I go there. So the precious, precious, precious 12 steps that we have to continue to take personal inventory, to look where I'm selfish, dishonest, frightened. You know, my girls, man, I'm telling you, we are inventory girls. We are about setting things right. If I harmed you, I mean, I'm rolling around last night like crazy. I didn't sleep till 2 o'clock in the morning easy because I'm excited and I want to throw up and I want to poop at the same time, you know, all that going on. And I'm like, April, did I keep you up? I need to make a direct amends. Like, because it's vital for my sobriety. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and you loved me, and you became my family, and I could sit, Polly, you know, it's so funny, like, we have this conversation about the old Northwest group, you know, and she's like, but that place brought you Peter, and that place brought me the fellowship. I was heavy fellowship. It was coffee, it was Denny's, it was cigarettes, it was all that stuff for a long, long time, So I treasure that, but the thing I'm saying about that is, this is my chair. This is my chair. And the deal is that if I can continue to clean my side of the street, if I can continually look at where I'm dishonest, where I'm selfish, where I'm self-seeking, and where I'm afraid, because everything boils down to fear anyway, I'm afraid. I mean, one of my go-tos, Polly knows it. She's, call me first before you freak out on Peter about that girl who thinks he's hot, you know? She's just like, call me first. You know, I don't have an attachment. I'm jealous. I'm not enough. Because instantly, I'm 6 years old. She's pretty. She's tall. Oh, my God. He's spiritual. I can see how she's perfect for him. You know, go-to. I'm not enough. But one of the things that we do, you know, it's like anytime I'm doing that, I had this friend, B.R. Bradbury, and he has since gone to the big meeting in the sky, and he was a radio guy in L.A., and he was part of Northwest, and we used to go into treatment centers and share our story a lot, and I just adored him. But there was a page in Daily Reflections on November 11th, which is my anniversary, is this really great reading, if you have one, and it talks about, you know, I'm going to botch this, but, you know, that I am one of God's children in, you know, and my most urgent life task is to love, nurture, and take care of me. Because when I'm saying I'm not enough, I'm disagreeing with God. And when I'm saying I'm a lot, I'm disagreeing with God. Because then I'm up here, right? And when I'm saying, you know, when it even goes, I'm telling you, people knock acceptance because it's not in the first 164 pages. But you know what? I get a lot out of that. Because when I'm disturbed, I find some person, some place, something not to my liking. That ain't my business. You know, in the beautiful rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, or Al-Anon has taught us that. Where's my hula hoop, and where am I okay? You know, I can have a life. I can be sober, and I can drink rock stars and monsters, and I can stay up all night long, and I can gossip all night long, and I can probably stay some sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. We can do that for a long time. You know, we can. I can stay sober on grace. I don't have anything to do with this. Sometimes we can worship the things that point to the thing that keeps us sober in the first place. I can worship my sponsor. I can worship the steps. I can worship men. I can worship clothes. I can, you know, I can do, or, you know, I can put all these things in front of what is pointing me right straight to God. So when I talk about my seed and I talk about that continuous inventory, it's something I'm so passionate about. So what that looks like for me today is a continuous inventory. What it looks like for me in step 11 is to seek through prayer and meditation this relationship with God. And I can tell you, on my knees, I became a Baptist. I'm like, whatever. Then I was a Pentecostal worship leader. Then now I'm a Catholic. And, you know, I'm just a little bit, you know, I love a little bit of Buddha. All-inclusive, never exclusive. The realm of the Spirit is broad and roomy. There's room for all of us. You know, I'm raised in Bellingham, Washington. In the 70s, it was the hippie capital of the world. You know, and I was always about that. Can't we just, you know, when you're in a home of scary stuff, you know, it's like, can't we all just get along, you know? And so that's the thing. This is the things that keep me clean, keep me being able to go. You know, that I left that husband and my friends, the Moody's, David and whatever, invite me over. And I'm like freaking out. I'm this super church woman and I'm coming out of the marriage. And they're Buddhists and they have this whole temple set up in their house. And I walked in and I went, ew. And the next voice I heard, listen, that was spiritual pride. Yuck, yuck, yuck. And God just spoke to my heart. Guess what? In our southern friend, he explains who the intuitive voice of God, a thought with a voice. One of the greatest descriptions I ever heard of the voice of God. You know, a thought with a voice. I'm here. And I stopped looking at that stuff, and I stopped looking at that. You know, I can see, you know, I love great outdoors, great outdoors. I love gift of desperation. I love gift of group of drunks. I love, God in the, who said that human being whatever thing? Now I really botched that one. But it's a God of our understanding, because guess what? We are together. And the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is we're the only place on earth, and I'm going to say this, you know, by God's grace and God's mercy, we're all here. And we're the only place on the planet that I've seen that it doesn't matter what our religious background, what it is together. You get in. I've been in great cathedrals and felt God, and I've been in an AA meeting with a drunk on their knees crying out to God and doing a third step. Broken, coming in smelling like booze. And that's home. And God's there. God's there. My friend Willie used to come too in an AA meeting. He'd go right in. He's like, pass out on the bench, come up. You know. And I learned this from my friend. He said, God loves the smell of booze in an AA meeting. Oh, smell of booze in an AA meeting. How dare they drunk come into a meeting? Oh, my God. Oh, my God, what if God ever did that? Wow, that would have been cool, you know? So I have no idea how long I'm going right now. But so all those trails and all those places... to know that I'm a woman that seeks God with desperation of a drowning woman. Candace described it so well. My life depends on that. My life depends on you. My life depends on working with others. My life depends on what's my new thing, whether it's the four agreements, the seed of contemplation, you know, like what's my new book? What's my new thing? What's the, you know, to grow in understanding and effectiveness of this power. This power. I'm a girl who couldn't stay sober for a weekend. Are you kidding me? I couldn't, a Friday night? Are you kidding me? I couldn't do that. But somehow, I didn't earn it. I didn't deserve it. It's reckless, abandoned love of God just picking me up day to day, no matter how dishonest, no matter how just screwed up I am, no matter how insecure, no matter how fearful I am, none of that stuff. So I just want to read something, and then I'm going to close, but just know, like I said, the passion of my heart. Peter always says this, you know, to me, I'll get all screwed up in the head before I do a talk. Just blah, 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 blah. You know, oh my God, I got to be super spiritual. Super Marian has to show up. It's just retarded. And one of the greatest things he ever told me was just do Marian. Just do Marian. So let's do something together. Put your hand on your heart. Say to yourself, just do, and say your name on three, okay? One, two, three. Just do. Oh my God, that was beautiful. Oh my God, that was cool. Okay, so I'm going to try to do this. It's something that, you know, I didn't even hear this. You know, we can continuously learn and grow in the rooms of alcoholics, and I love it. And what I did was I text messaged myself this link. Let's see if I can do it. I didn't even hear this till this last year. There may be some wonderful old timers that know this so, so well. And there may be some people that don't know it, but it's a poem by Sam Shoemaker. He's a great friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we all have our place. We all have our significance. We all have that thing for that drunk who needs us. But this is called I Stand at the Door. Stand by the door. Okay. And I just got a voicemail from a sponsee. Okay, here it goes. I stand by the door. I neither go in too far nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It's the door through which men walk when they find God. There's no use me going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where the door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing that there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men and women to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing that any man can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. Men die outside the door as starving beggars die on cold nights and cruel cities in the dead of winter, die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it just because they have not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door. Go in, great saints. Go in, go way in. Go way down into the cavernous cellars and way up on the spacious attics. It's vast, it's roomy house, this house where God is. Go into the deepest of hidden, Go into the deepest of hidden casements of withdrawal, of silence, of sainthood. Some must inhabit those inner rooms and know the depths and heights of God and call outside to the rest of us how wonderful it is. Sometimes I take a deeper look in, sometimes venture in a little farther, but my place seems close to the opening, so I stand by the door. There's another reason why I stand there. Some people get partway in and become afraid, lest God in the zeal of his house devour them, for God is so very great and asks all of us. And these people feel a cosmic claustrophobia and want to get out. Let me out, they cry. And the people way inside only terrify them more. Somebody must be by the door to tell them that they're spoiled. For the old life, they have seen too much. One taste of God and nothing but God will do me more. Somebody must be watching for the frightened who seek to sneak out just where they came in to tell them how much better it is inside. The people too far in do not see how near these are to leaving, preoccupied with the wonder of it all. Somebody must watch for those who entered but would like to run away. So for them too, I stand by the door. We're almost done. I admire the people who go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who've not yet even found the door, or the people who want to run away again from God. You can go in too deeply and stay in too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my old accustomed place near enough to God to hear him and to know he's there, but not so far from men as not to hear them. And remember, they are there too. Where? Outside the door. Thousands of them, millions of them. But more important for me, one of them, two of them, 10 of them, whose hands I'm intended to put on the latch. So I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I would rather be a doorkeeper, so I stand by the door. Thank you so much, women.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.